ask your doctor about Air Supra, albuterol budesonide. Eligible patients can pay as little as $0 per inhaler, subject to eligibility rules and maximum savings limits. Restrictions may apply. Visit airsuprasavings.com to learn more.
Going for your first ever run around the park. Literally running errands all over town. Running for the finish line and your personal best. If you run, you're a runner. Find the shoes and clothes to run your way at newbalance.com/running. New Balance. Run your way.
If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
This episode of See Here is brought to you by Oi! I'm fucking hit you!
Welcome to the latest episode of the See Here podcast. Now, regular listeners, I think there's three or four of you out there, might have noticed that I'm not Morris. This is actually Bernie taking the reins this week. Morris is otherwise indisposed, but he insisted that we continue without him. So we're no
the
longer...
The show must go on.
Absolutely. We're not a Fab He's Four this freak. Week. We're a power trio, and as you can hear, the other members of the power trio are already trying to upstage me, upstage my drum solo with their drum solos.
Yeah.
So, here we go. I'm Bernie, and across the great Atlantic Ocean, we have Wendy in Chicago.
Hey, friends!
Hey, Wendy. And we have Tim in South Korea.
Howdy.
How's it all going, guys?
Wonderful.
Yeah, it's going.
Good. Good. Are you comfortable we can make this happen without Morris?
You know, it'll be hard, and you'll have to edit out my weeping, my hysterical
sure.
weeping.
Well, we've already spent 20 minutes trying to calm you down, so I think hopefully we're through the worst of it.
our faithful Jedi Master is still here in spirit.
Yeah, absolutely. He is with us always.
Mm-hmm.
So
he lives in my heart.
Yeah.
And on my wall of crazy pictures I printed out of him.
Yeah? Is that the telephoto lens is working now, yeah? And the restraining order's been lifted. Cool. All right. Well, I think we're a little pressed for time this week, so if we just jump straight into, you know, what you've been watching, listening to, and tell us a little about that, I guess. Do you want to go first, Wendy?
Oh, gosh. What have I been watching? Well, I went to see, in the movies, I saw John Wick a couple times in the theater.
Oh,
with
okay.
Keanu
yeah.
Reeves.
Yeah. I know Awesome Fabian is a huge fan of this one. So, is it awesome?
Yes, it's totally awesome. I give it an A++.
Oh, yes.
I enjoy that. Oh, and the David Bowie exhibit is at the Museum of Contemporary Art here in Chicago.
Okay, nice.
And, it's the only appearance in America.
Why?
And it's pretty tremendous, as you know, a whole bunch of props and costumes and all the, you know, stuff from every genre, every era of his career, and it's pretty extensive, so it's very, very impressive, and it's only here for like two more weeks, so.
Nice.
I heard a rumor that somebody told me that at some point they had Iggy Pop behind glass.
Can you tell the difference between Iggy Pop and the Iggy Pop waxwork model? I don't think there's much between it these days, is there?
No.
Yeah. So, good girl, Madame Tussauds.
Yeah, absolutely. Are you a big Bowie fan, Wendy, or are you just sort of interested in him as a, you know, from a kind of historical...
Well, aren't we all?
Yeah, well, I got to be honest.
I'm
Mr. Bowie Contrary like... again. I'm not a huge Bowie lover, to be honest, but...
I feel Bowie is like the Beatles. I feel like there's an era of him for everyone, you know? I feel like there's something, like, when you have someone whose career has spanned so much and changed so much and influenced so much, I feel like there's something there for everyone, you know? Or even if you don't like something, you know?
Have you ever seen the movie, you ever seen the Woody Allen film Zelig?
Yes, yeah.
Yes, years ago.
Well, I think Bowie is like Zelig.
Yeah.
You know? He's absolutely like that. He whatever he wants to kind of, you know, mold himself into, he becomes. You know, he's just like the eternal space chameleon.
Yeah,
he's just the space chameleon. You know, yeah.
Like they have like all the diagrams of the things that he drew out for all of his stage design, and like how he was really in charge of like every aspect of all these things about these giant tours. And you know, I think it was just fascinating. And you know, also his film career. He's one of those few musicians who's been able to be a convincing actor in any way. You know, like I mean, I really enjoy A Man Who Fell to Earth and Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence. You know, his stage career when he was in The Elephant Man. I feel like Bowie's just an interesting iconic symbol.
He was one of the ones that actually, have you guys ever seen the footage of Bowie from the late 70s with Klaus Nomi?
Yeah, I've heard about
it. Yeah, when the TVC 1-5, the live version with Carlos Alomar. Oh, that's amazing. Like, that's really, really amazing. But, you know, what's really funny I find about Bowie is a lot of people have been telling me for a long time. They said, you got to watch this series, The Venture Brothers, right? And I had never seen it. So that I started watching the back seasons of The Venture Brothers. And the guy who created The Venture Brothers is huge into Bowie, because Bowie's actually in the cartoon. And they even have, like, one of the ships is called, the rockets is called TVC-15, the jet. And then they have a guy called the Action Man in it. And there's all these little sprinklings of, and Klaus Nomi's in the cartoon, and Iggy's in the cartoon. And it's bizarre, like how there's, you know, how far Bowie has actually kind of permeated pop culture and whatever.
Why?
Yeah, absolutely. So I feel like even if you don't like his music, I feel like you have to respect his, you know, his influence on things.
Can I be controversial, or do you just not want to hear me badmouthing someone else?
No, go right ahead.
Personally, I think Bowie is very good at picking up on trends, surrounding himself with the right people and stealing from the correct people who, you know, might not be in the public gaze, public view, and maybe passing some of that stuff off as being a bit more original than it actually is. So I'll be honest, I think he's a better actor than he is a musician, but that's just me. It's my job to be controversial around here, and I'm keeping my end up. So,
what was that film he did where he played Tesla? Did you see that?
Oh, the magician one.
Yeah,
That's the Chris Nolan movie, isn't it? Yeah,
yeah, that was great. I thought that was really good.
Yeah.
Unless we forget the Linguini incident with Rosanna Arquette.
Mm-hmm.
Listeners at home are freaking out, yelling the name of this movie. That was it. The
It's The Illusionist, isn't it? The Illusionist?
No.
The Prestige.
The Prestige.
Yeah. Yeah, no, he's very good in that, isn't he? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally.
And then there's the bit in Twin Peaks where he's only in the film for like 2 minutes.
And again, he's fantastic in that.
Yeah, Fire Walk With Me.
Yeah, good stuff. All right, Tim, so what have you been watching or listening to?
Well, more of a perspective here. Last night it officially happened. I hit that moment in my lifetime where I realized, fuck, am I old? Jesus. I went out last night and, you know, I was trying to be social. In Seoul, there was a number of Christmas parties and events going on. So I knew a friend of mine had told me that this one bar, Orange Tree, that they were having a Saturnalia electronic goth event type of thing, right?
Oh, that sounds like I'd be old already. Go on.
I'm old just listening to this, yeah.
So, I stopped in at a couple other places before, you know, I'd seen friends and stuff, and then I thought, okay, I'll just pop in there and catch my friend. So I go in there, and, you know, it's just a little tiny bar. And initially, I'm just feeling like, oh, wait a minute, man, this is a big mistake, you know? And then I go up to the DJ guy, and I'm just trying to say to him, hey, man, could you play She's in Parties? And he's like, who does that? And I'm like, Bauhaus. And he's like, oh, okay. And then I asked him, I said, well, could you play Smothered Hope by Skinny Puppy? And he goes, oh, I'll have to find it. And then he just goes on the internet and starts searching on his little laptop. And I was just like, oh, jeez, man, this is going to be a good night, you know? And then, you know, I can't criticize because everybody's got their own stance and everybody's got their own take on things. And they glean value out of that. And that's great by me. But, you know, it's like I'm looking and I see these kids and it's like, how can I describe them as like, they're almost like rainbow bright PVC rainbow bright kids, you know.
I know what you're talking about.
And they're just, and it's like, you know, they're glittery. And I almost wanted to say, "Oh, you're those sparkly vampires, right?" You know. But you know, but I sat there and I had a gin and tonic, and you know, and I kind of, you know, perused the surroundings. And then after that, I just kind of went, "Man, I don't, you know, I almost that goddamn song." Pop right into my head, the line in that song over and over again. I don't belong here. You know, and it was just like, so I left. And all the way home, I just basically listened to Joy Division on my iPod just to cleanse that whole thing out of my head, you know. But
I think it happens to all of us, Tim. You know, it's just the way it works. You know, we're kind of becoming obsolete and, you know, the next generation and next generations. Or, you know, stepping up and, wrong.
It's not anything about being obsolete. I think it's just that, again, I'm not trying to say, well, back in our day, it was so much better, you know.
But it was.
Yeah, but you know, it just seems like everything is so diluted now. It just seems like everything is so neutered. Everything is so, like, you know, I don't know.
It's funny. I was reading in I don't know if either of you are aware of a magazine called The Wire.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. I was reading in the latest issue a piece in there about how there isn't an underground anymore. How everything has been commodified, and you know, you can find anything within seconds on the internet. Even the most obscure LP, you can find some sort of vinyl rip of it somewhere. Yeah. And everything's cross-pollinated to such an extent that, you know, there is no underground. There is nothing new or shocking anymore.
Well, there's a great Noswald article about, like, geek culture and about how, like, there's no such thing as, like, really being a geek anymore because everybody just finds everything about this thing that they decided they're into in minutes. And once again, it's just like punk culture and music culture, like, in America... you know, in the 70s or 80s, like, every different city had its own different vibe. Every different city had its own punk scene. Everything had a different sound to it because you didn't necessarily know what the other people were doing on the West Coast or whatever. And that was the excitement of when bands started touring was you got to hear what Minneapolis sounded like, what San Francisco sounded like.
Yeah.
And we don't have regionality anymore. That's the problem. We just don't have any regionalism.
Yeah.
Well, I think, you know, culture and the internet today has become kind of like the Eye of Mordor, where everything just gets sucked into it, you know? I mean, and no, like you were saying, Bernie, you know, about no underground now. It's like, you know, for example, like when we talked about G.G. Allin, everybody thought, man, like nobody is going to glean onto this or nobody's going to want to look him up, you know? And lo and behold, it's like MTV, 10 most shocking rockers of all time. And he's like number one, you know?
Jeez,
so, man. I mean... Everything gets absorbed, man. I mean, even like you look back in the 90s, serial killer culture. I mean, all that got absorbed by popular media, man.
Absolutely.
I mean, you know,
and now we're all sat down watching Hannibal every week and talking about, well, right. You know, it's not as gory as the last season. So,
right.
Yeah, no.
So it's really
strange times.
Yeah, it's weird, man. It's just, you know. So anyway, no, I just felt kind of incredibly like, I don't know. It's weird. It's like I felt almost like the Ebenezer Scrooge's ghost, where it's just like, you know, it's like, here we see the bar of the future. Look, you know, and I'm just like, no, I don't want to look. It's bad.
Again, I just choose to believe that I'm old, but that there are younger people than me who are doing something cool, and I just don't happen to know about it. I would
I'm sure that's the case, Wendy. I mean, they're out there. You know, it's going to happen.
Yeah.
I think this, you know, it's just part of getting older. It's, you know, change happens, doesn't it? So, we just have to deal with it. You know, take some more antidepressants and just keep on going, you know?
Right. So, or anybody gets in the way, you just hit them in the nose with your cane.
Yeah, damn right. Yeah. Yeah. It works for ginger.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Anything else you wanted to mention, Tim, or were you just...
No, I'm good.
I just wanted to mention a few things quickly. Saw a movie last week, Tommy Lee Jones's latest directorial effort called The Homesman, which was fantastic. Very, very good. Very, very bleak and dark as well. It went in some directions I wasn't expecting it to, so I would wholeheartedly recommend that. Tommy Lee Jones is excellent in it, and Hilary Swank is really good in it as well. And also,
the Garcia?
Is it The Three Burials of Melchior Estrada?
Yeah, that's the one. I saw that. That was really good. I like that.
He's obviously got a very sort of deep affection for Westerns and the whole kind of, you know, mythology of the West as well as the actual history of the West. Even though The Three Burials of Melchior Estrada was a contemporary film, it still very much had a Western vibe.
Right.
And The Homesman is full-on Western. But, you know, I don't want to say too much, give too much away, but it is excellent. And if you get a chance to check it out, you totally should.
Leans toward Italy?
No, not really. If anything, it's got that vibe of maybe some of the sort of early 70s American Westerns, things like The Hired Hand. So it's got that kind of reflective, slow, sort of elegiac kind of feel to it, you know?
I see.
But yeah, really good. Excellent. And I just wanted to mention a book which I picked up the other day, which you probably both be interested in. You might have it already. It's a book called Gimme Indie Rock. By a guy called Andrew Earls, who is, he's written for Spin, Vice, Pitchfork, Magnet, The Onion, all sorts of things. But this is basically, subtitled 500 Essential American Underground Rock Albums, 1981 to 1996. And it's basically a kind of year by year, it's alphabetical, listing of just exactly what it says, 500 cool American indie rock albums. And I'm just flicking through it. It's got like Moss Icon. It's got, Jewelbox. It's got Jan Deck in there. The Gits. Godhead Silo. Blonde Redhead. This is basically, you know, my teens and early 20s in book form. So, it's a nice little wallow in nostalgia.
So it's pretty obscure, right? I mean, like, it hits a lot of the,
It does, yeah. The more, it goes both ways. I mean, you know, obviously it's got Nevermind in there, and it's got some fairly big, you know, well-known LPs, but it's got a lot of, you know, a lot of obscure stuff in there as well, which I was really pleased to see, because normally these kind of things, you know, it's just retreading what is the accepted mythology about that kind of thing.
Right.
You know, it's got the first Toiling Midgets LP in there, so as far as I'm concerned, it's good stuff.
They better have some Steel Pole Bathtub in there.
It's got about four of their albums in there, Tim.
Yeah.
The guy who writes it is obviously a big Steel Pole Bathtub fan. So, yeah, it's worth picking up. You know, if you're even a rudimentary interest in that kind of thing, I think you'll get something out of it. So,
right.
So there you go. Put it on the Christmas list, guys.
Yeah.
All right. So, anything else, or shall we take a little break and then jump into our review? Oh, geez, do you know, I've not even mentioned what we're doing this week. Wow.
What kind of host are you?
Yeah, I know.
You're fired.
This hosting business is a lot more difficult than it looks. So, we're doing, it's Wendy's pick this week. And Wendy, you picked Beware of Mr. Baker from 2012, which I'm sure any savvy music fan out there will know is a documentary about Mr. Ginger Baker, one of the greatest drummers of all time. So, yeah, we'll take a little break and we will come back and discuss it.
Are you really going to hit me with the fucking...
I fucking well am! I'm going to fucking put you in hospital!
What? Oh my god!
Yes!
Right, and we're back. So, as I just mentioned before the break, the film we're discussing this week is Beware of Mr. Baker. As I said, this was Wendy's choice. So, Wendy, why don't you tell us why you picked the film and, you know, a little bit about it.
Oh, man. You know, it's so funny to me. Like, I was thinking about this as I was watching. I was thinking about that documentary about Lee Von Helm from last year or whatever, and the documentary about Grant Hart that's available on Hulu. Man, drummers are some crotchety-ass people. I suppose, I don't know, maybe I'll age and be angry. Well, I'm pretty angry now. All right, maybe it's all true.
I don't know, maybe I was going to say you're the exception that maybe that proves the rule, Wendy. So I know Morris is pretty crotchety, isn't he?
But yeah, I just... but... I picked this because, you know, like the myth and the story. Oh, and Buddy Rich, there's a crotchety asshole too.
Oh, jeez, yeah.
I just feel like Ginger Baker is, there's such a legend and a mythos about him, and yet he is always sort of like put down under Bonham and Keith Moon and so forth. But like, I just really want to see something that highlighted how transcendental his drumming was and how much influence he had on so many things.
So are you a big Ginger fan yourself, Wendy? Or have you been influenced by his?
Not really. Not really. Cause okay. I would never choose to listen to Cream or Blind Faith. My mother loved Cream and she loved Blind Faith. And I don't ever want to hear their music again. But
I can relate to that. Yeah.
Exactly. He's an amazing drummer. Especially I loved all the stuff I'd work with Fela Kuti that they did in the movie. Like, I really feel this movie showcased, like, how different he was from, you know, the drummers at that time, and I enjoyed it. I enjoyed his style, and I enjoyed everything he did, and what a fucking raging dick he is.
I don't mince words there, Wendy.
No.
What about you, Tim? Are you a fan of Ginger, or are you a fan particularly of any of his bands, his musical output? Oh,
absolutely. Absolutely. Pretty much all of it. And, you know, the thing is like a lot of people, Ginger always gets compared to Bonham and Moon. But whereas Mooney would destroy his drum set, I think Ginger would destroy you with his drum set. And, you know, I cannot overstate the absolute monumental influence that Ginger has had on rock and roll. And, I mean, you know, it's no word of a lie or exaggeration, like in the film when they talk about how he was one of the first to actually go over to Africa and kind of bring that whole sound, that rhythm, that four,
yeah,
bring it to North America and bring it to Europe. I mean, yeah. And whereas, you know, a lot of other drummers were that kind of more that, you know, Ginger had that. He was the guy. He had the thud, you know. Yeah. Ginger brought that thud. Where, and I think that was his contribution to music. I mean, shit, well, when you... Sorry, Wen, go ahead.
Oh, no, no, like, that was the thing, was that he also, he could swing, like, he could swing like a motherfucker, and they totally point that out, too.
It's right? interesting that, you know, they kind of mention at various points in the film that he pretty much invented rock drumming. He was the right. rock drummer, but at the same time, he's not a rock player, he's a jazz player, isn't he?
No. Well, you see, this is the thing, right, is that I think that... I don't want to speak for you, Wen, because I'm not a drummer. But from my perspective, I've always found that rock drummers could just play rock, whereas jazz drummers are more versatile and they can play all kinds of variations of things, right?
I think that is true. But then they're also, I feel like the greatest rock drummers are people who, yeah, who have such a jazz sense. But like Stuart Copeland, who was or Neil Peart or whatever, like they're great rock drummers because they can work around the beat, you know? Like,
yeah.
I loved when they explained that the beginning of White Room is like a 5/8 bolero.
Right.
You know, like, I liked it when how they explained things like that. Like there should be a different... Great, great drummers can play melodically and can play with a concept of timing... And playing within the music rather than just like chunka chunka, you know.
Like, it seems like there used to be more of a tradition of, I mean, you know, your basic rock beat is, I guess, just generally a 4/4 beat, isn't it? But it seems there used to be back in the 60s and 70s, there was more of a tradition of rock drummers who'd kind of learnt their arts, and as you say, they were able to play around the beat and play with the beat, and it wasn't right. just a straightforward thing. These were, you know, they were musicians. You know, I'm not saying that drummers aren't musicians, but they have more of a musical... You know, I'm thinking of someone like John Densmore from the Doors, for example. Mm-hmm. You know, I guess Ginger started that tradition in a way, or he was certainly one of the first.
Absolutely, and yeah. I think, you know, if you're any musician worth your grain of salt, I think that you really go back and you look at the foundations of what came before you. And I mean, the thing is like with Ginger, he looked at, you know, I mean, all those amazing jazz drummers that he grew up with. And then there was on top of that, what was his name? Pete Seeman.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Pete Seeman, when he, when Pete Seeman introduced him to all the Burundi and the Congo drums.
Yeah.
And I mean, so it was a combination. It was that mix, almost like a speedball of, you know, the African with the traditional jazz.
Yeah.
And like you said, Wendy, he could swing, but then he also brought that thud. And then when it was a combination of the two, you know, that was, you couldn't beat that. And
let's discuss, how fucking cool was it when he would do those big drum battles, those challenges with the people that he admired?
When he was playing with Art Blakey, that was unbelievable. Just unbelievable.
Buddy Miles, holy shit.
Elvin, like, who ever had the balls to just be like, yeah, I'm just going to get my idols, and I'm just going to challenge them, we'll do this. Like, that's the thing, I feel like modern drumming is missing this showmanship. It's missing that sort of, like, crazy, and... Yeah, it's so funny because I'm so torn about a lot of things in life. And I'm so torn because I love good pop music, and I love things that aren't, like, big and flashy. Like, I hate guitar noodling. I hate songs over, you know, over 3 minutes and so forth. But then again, I love it when people can showcase their craft. I love it when, you know...
But there's a difference
between... You know what's
really
funny about that? Sorry, go ahead, Bernie.
I was going to say that there's a difference between being able to really play... and just showing off. Do you know what I mean? Because, you know, when, you know, Ginger and I are, you know, in the middle of that drum bar, when Ginger's playing at any point, he's not showing off. He's just so deeply into it. It's just, it's almost like he's channeling something. It's just flowing out of him. It's who he is.
Right.
And it's very telling that the only time he really shows any emotion in the film is when he's talking about, you know, playing with Art Blakey and Max Roach, how these idols of his, who he's, you know, he's been so lucky to actually play with, and he can even count on as friends. That's the only time he shows any emotion at all in the film.
Right. Well, there's three things that I wanted to say. That the first one was You know, when he had those drum challenges, he was talking about how he said, you know, when you're really playing with people that are good because you're playing together.
Yes.
You're not playing against each other. Yeah, you're playing together, right? And then the second... Go ahead, Wen.
Yeah, like it wasn't a competition. Like at the end, they would come together.
Yeah, right. And then what you were talking about, Bernie, when you said, you know, he was so into it. There's the piece in the film where they're interviewing Carlos Santana. And Santana said, I saw them the first time that Cream came to San Francisco, the first North American tour, and they were playing that supersonic music, I think he said.
He does, yes. When
he says, you know, that's when, you know, the power of the spirit gets into you and you don't even know what you're doing there. Yeah. You're just doing it, you know. And that's where when you see Ginger play, it's like he's not even there. It's like he's not, and I've been lucky to see a few bands that have hit that sweet spot once in a while. It doesn't happen all the time, but you know when it's like you're not there, they're not there, but something is happening, you know, and yeah.
It's a very rare thing, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And with his drums, when you say the only time he kind of shows any emotion is Ginger's going on about a point in the film where he says, I told my wife early on, he said, if I have a choice between choosing you or my drums, I'm going with my drums, you know?
So,
and also, can we discuss, like, some of the people speaking about, like, Eric Clapton was very tactful, I thought. Came off very close.
No, absolutely. To be honest, I think Jack Bruce was as well, wasn't he?
Yeah. And I feel this is kind of touching now with the recent loss of Jack Bruce, too. Now, that was one that hit me pretty hard, too, because, you know, it's so funny, though, because it's like, there's no way Cream would have been Cream without Ginger, but I mean, and without Jack, you know?
Well,
but
everybody always, sum of all three of them, wasn't it? It was just unique.
Right, sure.
Yeah.
But everybody always thinks of Cream as Clapton's band, right?
Oh, God.
Like, a lot of people do, man. They say, oh, that was Clapton's band, but it wasn't. Because
well, Ginger's
Jack
very forthright and... You know, saying it was his thing and he put it together and it was, you know, it was my band. But I think he says that about pretty much every endeavor he's involved in.
Right. And, you know, it's so funny because it's like, I kind of look at Ginger like a metaphor for, he's like drugs. Because, I mean it in the sense that it's like, he would show up in places and people would love him for a while. And then it would be just like, no, I can't do this anymore, man. I can't handle this anymore. And then he'd just go on somewhere else and they'd burn the house down. And no, I can't do this anymore, you know.
Funny is one of his ex-wives towards the end says he's either got a problem staying or a problem in that he has to leave.
Yeah.
Know, it's he can't stay, so he's got to leave. It's always, the problem isn't that he's always leaving. The problem is that he can't stay, if that makes sense.
Right. Yeah. No, but there's the bit where, you know, they finally Clapton just says, fuck it, I've had enough, you know, between Ginger and Jack going at it.
Yeah.
And then so he decides to go and, you know, shack up with Stevie Winwood, you know,
with
Blind Faith. And then lo and behold, who shows up? Ginger.
Yeah, why didn't you call me, man? I'm here, I'm ready.
Yeah. And it's like, and Clapton's just like, oh, fuck.
Cool. So I just wanted to mention a little bit about the documentary itself. It was directed by a guy called Jay Bolger, who apparently wrote an article about Ginger Baker for Rolling Stone. The documentary kind of came out of that.
Like, that kid didn't even work for Rolling Stone. He just lied
to go
and live with Ginger Baker.
Well, that was just it totally reminded me of reminded me of what's the Cameron Crowe film?
Almost Famous,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, totally. I wanted to see what you guys thought. I mean, it's a fairly straightforward documentary, and it follows Ginger from his, you know, from childhood through his career up to where he is now, or where he was like 2 years ago when it was made. So I just wondered what you guys thought of it as a piece of filmmaking, as a documentary. I mean, there was a lot of sort of little animated sequences.
Yeah, I love
and
that.
A lot of talking
really,
so did
I
you think
that.
It was successful as a piece of filmmaking?
Oh, yeah.
Well, it's interesting because it didn't really have a trajectory. Like, it was just like, look at Ginger Baker, isn't this dude fucked up? It wasn't like, an evolution of like a specific event or something. Yeah. It was just very, very much this sort of like you know, flashback of his life, you know.
Yeah.
No, I thought it was beautiful. All the animated sequences, a lot of it was really fantastic and touching. I mean, especially like when they incorporated bits of his father.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then the past, and then there were some really cool bits, because I forget where it was in the beginning when it's got Ginger talking and then it's like it slows right down during the animation. And it's like he's tripping out in the animation. You know?
I think that's when he was talking about doing the cocktail of heroin, LSD and cocaine. With Graham
right,
wasn't it? Yeah.
Right. But then, and then there's the thing where you see, like, for example, when he's lost in the rhythm, and you see where Ginger's on the slave ship, where he's playing the drums.
Yeah.
You know, and there's all that. I thought that was really cool. Like, I thought it was amazing. Like, it looked like pencil sketches almost, or almost like
pastel. Yeah. I thought it had almost that sort of scratchy Gerald scarf kind of feel.
Yeah, exactly. But I thought it was really great the way it was incorporated into the film. It just wasn't talking heads and snapshots. That there was an actual style to it.
Yeah.
Which I thought, you know, really added to the film, because
yes.
You know,
yeah. Now, do you think, I mean, obviously, you know, one could never tell without knowing the people involved, but do you think it was a fair portrait of Ginger Baker?
I think it was a fair portrait because, I mean, obviously you got to see enough of his behavior. You got to see, I mean, he's pretty open about it, yeah, to the level of person he is, you know? So I feel like it was definitely fair. Like, he didn't disagree with anyone. And like we were saying about Clapton and Jack Bruce and Steve Winwood, like, they all were very respectful of his legacy as well, you know, even though the guy's a raging fucking dick.
Yeah. Well,
as I said, most of them were pretty tactful.
I loved his ex-wives. Yeah. I loved, like, how he needed, he had at every concert he'd been to black hookers.
Yeah. I have a question, though, talking about wives. Here's the thing. When he's sitting at the kitchen table with his current wife, the African lady, and Jay asks her, is Ginger a good stepfather?
The longest pause in cinema history, wasn't it?
Right. Now, do you think she paused because she didn't understand it, or she was just petrified to answer?
I don't know. He would have beat her with his cane if she hadn't answered.
Yeah, like, no, it just seems like she sat there like, oh my god, what do I say? Like, it just seemed like she was, like, just totally on the spot, you know? And
I sort of the impression that she didn't quite understand.
That's initially what I thought, too, but I wondered if it was a little of both, you know? It's just like, don't you dare open your mouth, woman, you know? It's like, yeah.
Another one of my favorite moments is when he was describing his problems with degenerative arthritis and stuff. And Jay asks him, he's like, oh, is that why you haven't played drums in a while? And he flips out.
Yeah. It doesn't take much. He turns on a dime, doesn't he? And he's just like, what the fuck are you talking about?
Or what was it when he's like, you know, Jay says, so tell me what it was like working with, you know. So tell me what it was like working with, like, and he's sitting there fucking mocking him, eh? Like,
the Mick Jagger story.
Yeah, so tell me what it's like working with Mick Jagger, you know. And then he's just like, and this skinny little cunt gets up on stage, and I'm like, hey, who the fuck is this? You know, look at this little ponce, you know, it's like, yeah. But, you know, Ginger, though, the thing is, isn't it amazing, though, like, that I think that he's not just a cantankerous old fuck, because he only saw, you know, just a quick little snip of it, but when he was there with his stepdaughter in the car.
Yeah, totally.
Right?
Yeah.
And he was really civil and nice, you know, and I mean, you're going to be living in a cave because nobody will want to tolerate you in any way whatsoever, you know, and I think...
that's the interesting thing. A lot of the, again, you know, as you were saying, a lot of the people who were interviewed for the documentary, you know, they didn't come out and say, you know, he's an utter wanker, I want nothing to do with him. They were all obviously pretty fond of him, even though, you know, they totally recognised the fact that he was an extremely difficult person to be around. And if he was just a horrible piece of shit, you know, people would be saying that. So.
Well, that's like I'm saying.
Even when his son is talking about how, like, he would flip out on him and he'd be like, I wish you were black.
Yeah.
That's kind of like what I was saying, though, about Ginger being drugs. Is that, you know, everybody was like, oh, yeah, we were with Ginger. Yeah, man. But, you know, like, yeah, I had fun. But, no, can't make a life of it, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, that's what he was like, you know?
Well, maybe maybe he did make a life of it, and other people were just able to dip in and out of that. And he's the kind of... He's the worst case scenario. He's, you know, this is what happens when you, you know, this is your brain on drugs kind of thing. So it's fun to visit with Ginger for a while, but you don't want to live like Ginger. Yeah.
Right, exactly. Yeah. But, you know, the two things I wanted to touch on before I forget is the work he did in Africa with Fela. I mean, that's one of my favorite records of all time, that Live Africa 70 record that they did. You know, I defy anybody not to be able to shake their ass after listening to that album. I mean, like, to me, that's one of the most definitive party albums of all time, next to, like, you know, James Brown, you know.
Yeah.
Because it's just, man, that whole thing just gets you jumping. That whole album is just absolutely jaw-dropping when you realize it was live and there's no real overdubs that much on it. It's just unbelievable.
Yeah, incredible, isn't it? Yeah.
I loved the whole thing in that. First of all, I would love to watch that documentary about him driving through Africa. I really want to see that. But
Wendy, I've just got to interject here. You say you want to see that documentary. I want to see Nasty Boys. Do you remember Nasty Boys? This is when the guy said to him, look, you've got to come to Hollywood, Ginger, and make a film. He's in a low-budget action movie called Nasty Boys. I'm going to have to track that down. I didn't even know that existed.
That's when you find it. Wow. But it was so interesting, Wendy, he got really, really into polo. Like, he was playing with Fela Kuti, who was like this revolutionary, this fucking people's, you know, leader. And yet he gets really, really into polo and going to, like, the swank country club.
Yeah, the colonialists. That's one of the most privileged sort of sports, you know, you could get into, isn't it? It's not like you're just kicking a football around. It's just, insane.
But again, Ginger the drug, you know, like, you know, drugs are amongst the rich and drugs are amongst the poor, you know? I mean, like, drugs don't segregate. They'll go anywhere they go, you know? Anywhere anybody will take them, you know?
Yeah.
And the other thing I wanted to say, too, was about how, you know, he went around the world and wound up burning so many bridges. And I loved that part of the animation, too, where it was like everywhere Ginger went, there was a burning ship.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
That was beautiful. But, no, I love, in the end, like, one of my favorites to come out of the late 80s and early 90s was a band called The Masters of Reality.
I didn't know that he played on that album again. I was totally aware of that fact.
Yeah,
that's amazing
to me. Even before he played on Sunrise on the Suffer Bus, Masters of Reality, their sound was very reminiscent of Cream and very reminiscent of a lot of those power trios of the late 60s and 70s. And, you know, for Chris Goss, the singer of Masters, it was an ultimate dream come true to be able to play with Ginger. And I think he really, you know, looked at, revered Ginger like a treasure. And, you know, how he talks about in the film about how they were opening for Alice in Chains, and Ginger's out there just like, what the fuck is this, man? Like, this is bullshit, you know, like, I can't fit into this jacket, you know, this isn't me, you know, and I totally, you know, felt bad for him about that, you know.
What's crazy to think, you know, someone of his stature at that point, you know, he couldn't really even get arrested, no one would play with him,
no.
So, which is just insane.
But I think a lot of it is his, it was by his own doing.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, and I think a lot of it is, too, is that he was almost like Hunter Thompson, okay? People loved Hunter Thompson by proximity. And I think it was the same thing with Ginger, where everybody could recognize, you know, his craft, and they loved Ginger, but, like, from a distance, you know, and to his own detriment, you know?
Yeah.
That's what it happened, what it wound down to in the end.
He was just very good at pushing people away, it seems.
Right. And, you know, one of the hardest things that really, you know, I don't have any kids myself, but one of the hardest things I thought was pretty tough to hear was when Kopi, his son, says, you know, in some ways it would have been just better if Ginger had never had any kids at all, and that, you know, he would have left behind a smaller mess.
Yeah, that's pretty brutal, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, to hear the guy just straight up say that, it's like, holy shit, man. Yeah. He's, you know, you're talking about yourself, you know. Or else the daughter, too, when yeah. she says, yeah, mom and dad tried to abort me. Yeah.
Yeah, oh my gosh, that was Jeez. So crazy.
Yeah.
And she's like, oh, I don't mind. No, it's okay, you know.
Jeez. I think considering who their father was, they kind of seem pretty well adjusted.
That was, really? Seriously?
Yeah, kind of amazing. But it's interesting as well. You said earlier, Tim, that with his current wife and his stepdaughter, how he's obviously really fond of her. Mm-hmm. And yet, you know, he was an absolute shit to his own kids mm-hmm. for so long, particularly his son. Because I think his ex-wife says, you know, he wanted a son for so long and he finally got one and then he just treated him like crap.
Yeah.
So, yeah, a complicated man. Very complicated man.
And, you know, the one thing that I also wanted to mention too was that Neil Peart's in this.
Yeah.
I was surprised to see that they got an interview out of Neil Peart, because out of the three members of Rush, not that I'm any aficionado myself, but he's the one that always, like, I mean, Alex Lifeson and Getty are the ones that do most of the media stuff, and, yeah. and Neil Peart's more the guy that's behind the scenes, right? He really is not a, you know, kind of a social musician, yeah. Yeah. right? And I've always thought in my mind is that why do people just I understand, you know, the whole precept of being a celebrity and everything, but musicians are just people like anybody else. They don't have to be overly happy all the time and Absolutely. Overly open all the time and
yeah.
overly available all the time. I mean, like that's just something to me that, you know, is just assumed by you know, by society. And, you know, and I mean,
well,
yeah,
I guess it's indicative of that celebrity culture almost. It's like, you know, you're here sure. to entertain us. You've always got to be on, so...
Sure, yeah. sure, sure. So, I mean, you know, when there was times when Ginger wasn't so nice, man, you know, like, that's... I'm not saying it's acceptable. I'm just saying a lot of that's just the human condition, you know?
Yeah.
A lot of it, you know, it's addiction. It was, you know, I mean, neglect of his children, you know, and... But also, the funny thing is, too, is I think that his I think it was his sister, she talked about the Baker anger.
Yes, yeah.
In the beginning. And then yeah. he got that letter from his dad, where his dad just says, you know, your fists are your best friends.
Yeah, you know, be a man, stand up.
Be a man, stand up. Yeah, yeah, you know. And I think that, you know, I don't know if it was because of his lack of his own father or what. But I think Ginger Baker kind of had this kind of, you know, chunk of hot molten lava shoved up his arse for the majority of his life. And I think he just had this burning. And I think, you know, if he had never found his calling as a drummer, man, I think he would have wound up killing people.
Jeez, he'd be in prison, wouldn't he? Yeah.
Yeah, he would. I think he would. I think he would. There'd be no question about it. I think I think drums were his outlet to kind of channel what he did, you know?
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right, Tim. Yeah, cool. All right. So I wanted to sort of talk a little bit about the kind of current state of music documentaries, because there seems to be, you know, we're in kind of, I guess you could call it a golden age. There's just so many of them these days. Pretty much every band, obscure, famous, seems to have a documentary about them or a documentary in production. And I just I wonder what you guys felt about that. Are we in a golden age? And, you know, how does this fit into that kind of trend?
Oh, absolutely. And the thing that fascinates me is, like, I've noticed there are a lot of documentaries lately about punk in the Middle East, or you know, like yeah. we were talking before, regionalism yeah. and so forth. Like, I find it really interesting that there are these great documentaries coming out now about different genres of music in different parts of the world. I think that's really interesting. And or things like a band called Death. I love documentaries about bands that like I'd never listened to, like Anvil. That, you know,
yeah,
there
yeah.
are like some really good documentaries that aren't necessarily about big famous people or stories that are well told. I want to see a documentary about something that's not already told at that time.
Absolutely. I mean, that's, you know, 9 times out of 10, that's going to be more interesting than, you know, another fucking Metallica documentary or whatever. So, yeah.
I kind of love some monster just because at that time you didn't realize the sheer level of asshole
yeah.
they were.
And talking about Metallica, Lars Ulrich manages to weasel his way into this, doesn't he? But where Mr. Baker, he's got a few talking head moments in there. Actually, I've got a note here which just says Lars Ulrich is a wanker.
Two things I have to say about that. One, is it just me or is Lars Ulrich becoming Gollum?
Oh my god, yes. You never see him in the same room together, do you?
No, man. I can just see him behind the ring, behind the drum kit, and just like, you know, and James flips him a ring. My precious! My precious! But the other thing is, too, with Ginger, there's the bit where, now don't laugh by what I'm about to say, because it might sound like it's completely whack, but every time I saw Ginger with his hair and just the look on his face and everything, I always thought of a garden gnome.
Yeah, I can totally see that, yeah.
and then there's the bit with the Air Force where he's playing drums and he's got that blue beret on.
Oh my, yeah, he looks like he's in Gong or something, doesn't he?
Yeah, yeah, but he totally looks like a gardener.
Yeah.
He's got the beard and he's got that look and he's just got that smile on his face. He just looks like a garden gnome, you know. And now every time, you know, it's like I'll go somewhere in the wherever in the world and I'll be walking past somebody's house and I'll look down and see a garden gnome. I'll expect it to say, "Are you? Yeah. Fuck off."
You can guarantee out there somewhere you can get a little Ginger Baker ceramic garden gnome with his drumsticks. That's it. If I get you for Kringle next year, Tim, you want to expect something like that, okay?
Oh, sweet, sweet. But no, with the documentary, when you're talking about current state of documentaries,
sure, yeah.
We're obviously in a bumper crop, but the thing is, to me, is that just because there's a lot out there doesn't mean that they're good.
Yeah.
And what happens is when you wind up with a glut of things one way or another, just like the horror genre. Just because everybody says, "Well, horror is as healthy as it ever was." Well, that it's quantity. I mean, quality, not quantity. And that's the one thing that I really liked about this one was that, you know, there was a lot of care put into this film. I mean, with the animation, with some of the. I mean, like this guy Jay. If somebody from, you know, MTV or somebody from a kind of a more prestigious background had tried to approach Ginger, I'm sure he would have told him just to fuck off. But because Jay was just some schlub, this dude who just shows up and says, "Hey, I'm Jay. Hey, Ginger," you know, and he just shows up like this guy. I think it kind of put Ginger more, not at ease, because he's never at ease, but I mean, but it kind of gave him an in, because, you know, he was kind of like a lamb a little bit, you know. he kind of went in there and, you know, whereas anybody else would have been like, "Okay, puff piece," or, "Okay, we're going to shit on Ginger with this article," you know, or whatever, you know, and...
I guess he wasn't that sort of, you know, fawning sycophant type, because when he's talking about writing the article at the start, it's pretty apparent he didn't really know who Ginger Baker was.
Well, when he says he saw that film and he goes, I didn't know who this guy was. Yeah. I gotta meet this guy, you know, and he's just like, No, I think this documentary stands up there as one of the better films to see, and, you know, warts and all. I mean, you know, I think what's really funny is that a lot of artists on film, they might be very worried about how they're going to be construed. Whereas I think that Ginger doesn't give a single solitary fuck.
Yeah.
And so that's the difference. Whereas a lot of them, you know, like we're, you know, with Eric and Jack and these guys that are just like, "Oh yeah, yeah, Ginger's a mate, yeah. And then, you know, Ginger's like, "Oh fuck Jack and fuck Eric," and, you know, like, so he's not returning the service, you know, but that's just who he is, you know. I mean,
definitely, yeah.
You know, and I think that to tie back to, you know, the first film that we did, the G.G. Allen hated documentary. It's kind of the same thing where, you know, it's like, you know, he didn't care how he was kind of seen, you know.
Yeah.
He just this is what I am. You know, it's like, if you, you want, like it, great. You don't like it, great. I don't give a shit, you know?
Cool. All right, well, I think, Wendy, you've got to jump off, haven't you?
Yes, yes.
So I think that's probably a good point to wrap it up. So right. Would you guys, I take it this is a recommend from both of you?
Absolutely, and it's on Instant.
Cool. So you've got no excuse. You should all check it out. Okay, either of you remember who's...
whose choice is it next time?
That's what I was going to say. Does anyone remember whose choice it was? I've got a feeling it might be Morris's.
I think it was Morris's.
Yeah.
Yours last.
And Tim was the month before, wasn't it? So I reckon it must be Morris. So I guess we'll announce on the Facebook page what we're going to do next. So
right.
Yeah.
And before we go, I would like to wish all our two listeners out there. Hi, Mom.
Yeah.
I would like to wish all our listeners out there a very Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays, Happy Kwanzaa, you know, Joyous Noel, all that shit. And we'd like to wish everybody a safe and happy holiday season with your family. We wish everybody the best of health, and we hope you keep listening to the podcast, and we hope that everyone finds a lot of great films and a lot of great sounds they enjoy over the holidays.
Absolutely, I second that emotion. And can I just say as well, you know, if you enjoyed the podcast, recommend it to friends and family. Check us out on Facebook. If you search for See Here, you'll find the group. And look on iTunes as well, and maybe even leave us a review and send us feedback. Yeah, I think that's about it. Anything else, guys?
No.
Yeah. Oh, no.
No.
Happy holidays.
Happy holidays to everybody.
Happy holidays.
Thanks a lot, Tim. Thanks, Wendy.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening out there. Take care. This has been See Here, and we'll see you soon.
Cheers. This is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune into Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.